ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय So reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam 10th canto 3rd chapter text 18 Ya atmano drishya guneshu saniti Vyavyasyate svavyatirakto buddha Vinanu vadam nachatan manishitam Samyag yatas tyaktam upadadat puman Ya atmano drishya guneshu saniti Vyavyasyate svavyaktirakto buddha Vinanu vadam nachatan manisitam Samyag yatas tyaktam upadadat puman Ya atmano drishya guneshu saniti Vyavyasyate svavyaktirakto buddha Vinanu vadam cha tatam manishitam Samyag yatas tyaktam upadadat puman Vaishnavis. Ya. Anyone who. Atmanah. Of his own real identity, the soul. Drishyaguneshu. Among the visible objects. Beginning with the body. San. Being situated in that position. Iti. Thus. Vyavyasyate. Continues to act. Swavyatikata. As if the body were independent of the soul. Abhuta. A rascal. Vina anuvadam. Without proper analytical study. Na. Not. Cha. Also. Tat. The body and other visible objects. Manisatam. Such considerations having been discussed. Samyak. Fully. Yataha. Because he is a fool. Tyaktam. Are rejected. Upadadat. Accepts this body as reality. Puman. A person. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. One who considers his visible body, which is a product of the three modes of material nature, to be independent of the soul, is unaware of the basis of existence, and therefore he is a rascal. Those who are learned have rejected his conclusion, because one can understand through full discussion that with no basis in soul, the visible body and senses would be insubstantial. Nonetheless, although his conclusion has been rejected, a foolish person considers it a reality. Purport. Without the basic principle of the soul, the body cannot be produced. So-called scientists have tried in many ways to produce a living body in their chemical laboratories, but no one has been able to do it, because unless the spirit soul is present, a body cannot be prepared from material elements. Since scientists are now enamored of theories about the chemical composition of the body, we have challenged many scientists to make even a small egg. The chemicals in eggs can be found very easily. There is a white substance and a yellow substance covered by a shell, and modern scientists should very easily be able to duplicate all this. But even if they were to prepare such an egg and put it in an incubator, this man-made chemical egg would not produce a chicken. The soul must be added, because there is no question of a chemical combination for life. Those who think that life can exist without the soul have therefore been described here as abhuta. Foolish rascals. Again, there are those who reject the body, regarding it as insubstantial. They are the same category of fools. One can neither reject the body nor accept it as substantial. The substance is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and both the body and the soul are energies of the Supreme Godhead, as described by the Lord Himself in Bhagavad Gita, Chapter 7, Texts 4 and 5. Bhumer apo nalovya vayu, kam mano buddhadeva cha, ahankara itiyam ne bina prakritir astada, aparyam itastvanyam, prakritim vidine param jivabhuta mahabaho yayidam daryate jagat. Earth, water, fire, air, ether, mind, intelligence, and false ego, altogether these comprise my separated material energies. But besides this inferior nature, O mighty armed Arjuna, there is a superior energy of mine, which consists of all living entities who are struggling with material nature and are sustaining the universe. The body, therefore, has a relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, just as the soul does. Since both of them are energies of the Lord, neither of them is false, because they come from the reality. One who does not know this secret of life is described as a Buddha. According to Vedic injunctions, Aitat dat yam idam sarvam, sarvam kalavidam brahma. Everything is the Supreme Brahman. Therefore, both the body and the soul are Brahman, since matter and spirit emanate from Brahman. Not knowing the conclusions of the Vedas, some people accept the material nature as substance, and others accept the spirit soul as substance. But actually, Brahman is the substance. Brahman is the cause of all causes. The ingredients and the immediate cause of this manifested material world are Brahman, and we cannot make the ingredients of this world independent of Brahman. Furthermore, since the ingredients and the immediate cause of this material manifestation are Brahman, both of them are truth, satya. There is no validity to the expression Brahma satya jagan mithya. The world is not false. Jnanis reject this world, and foolish persons accept this world as reality, and in this way they are both misguided. Although the body is not as important as the soul, we cannot say that it is false. Yet the body is temporary, and only foolish materialistic persons who do not have full knowledge of the soul regard the temporary body as reality and engage in decorating this body. Both of these are pitfalls. Rejection of the body as false and acceptance of the body as all in all can be avoided when one is fully situated in Krishna consciousness. If we regard this world as false, we fall into the category of asuras who say that this world is unreal, with no foundation and no God in control. Asacham apratishtam te jigadahur anishvaram. As described in the 16th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, this is the conclusion of the demons. Omagina timidam dasha jananjana shalakaya chakshuram militam yena tasmai shri gadave namaha shri chaitanam anobishtam stapitam yena bhutale swayam rupa gadamayam dadati swaparantikam. So the practical form that these philosophical ideas come to us these days is called the Big Bang Theory. And it goes something like this. Once upon a time, there was a point of zero volume, right? Zero volume, but infinite temperature and density. And that point exploded and expanded. And as it expanded, somehow this zero volume, even though it was zero volume, it cooled down and to gases. And these gases somehow or another formed galaxies. And the galaxies formed stars and then planets. And then some living thing came about. And the living things developed eventually to human beings. And here we are. We're able to, and the human beings develop consciousness, and here we are able to sit here and talk about this and be aware of it and reflect on how amazing it is. Okay? So that's the practical form in which this this philosophy gets presented to the average Joe in the world today. But there's a few problems with that, to say the least. One of them is that it's never really been observed. You see, in other words, people are being expected to accept this, what would you call it, a theory and these ideas. And where do they come from? What's the basis of it? Well, I just printed out two paragraphs from a book called Vedic Cosmography and Astronomy, which was written by Sataputta Das, probably about 1987, 1988, so about 30 years ago, but which is relevant to this point. He says something interesting. He says, but here's a fact that few people realize. He's referring to this, the Big Bang idea, is what I just described. Even with the most powerful telescopes, it is not possible to actually see galaxies moving away from us. The images we see are static, and scientists would not expect them to show visible motion, even if observations could go on for centuries. So in other words, the scientists claim that there's observational evidence to support this idea, the Big Bang, that everything's moving away, all the planets are moving away from the galaxies are moving away from each other, the planets are moving away from each other, et cetera, et cetera. Actually, I mentioned this in a previous class. We distributed books up at the observatory, and the director of the observatory is Dr. Krupp. He's actually kind of a a bit of a famous astronomer. He's written a bunch of books, and he's hosted a TV show on PBS for a bunch, you know, some years. And so, you know, one day I kind of caught him. He parked his car, and he was walking towards the observatory. I was walking along with him, and I asked him about this, and he said, "Yeah, we have observational evidence. You know, we have observational evidence to support this idea of the Big Bang." You know, and I guess what he's referring to is what I'll read now. It says, so Sataputta goes, "So how do we really know the universe is expanding? All we have to go on is the light and other kinds of radiation that travel to us from across the reaches of interstellar space. Images formed from this radiation do not directly show universal expansion, but subtle features of the radiation have convinced scientists that this expansion is taking place." So in other words, if, say they took you into Mount Wilson and, you know, you went behind the big telescope there down on Mount Palomar, and, you know, you were there and they said, "Okay, now look through this telescope, and what do you see?" "Well, I see all these, you know, whatever, celestial bodies." "And what else do you see?" "Oh, I see some red lines." And they would go, "Aha! There you go. There's the proof. Those red lines you're seeing are what's called the spectral lines. It's what we call a redshift. And this redshift is actually the reason why we understand that everything, all the, you know, the stars and the planets and the galaxies and the universe, whatever, is all moving away from each other, because the redshift indicates a Doppler effect. In other words, that as things move away, that you see this, you know, redshift. You see this these red spectral lines. If they were moving closer, if everything was moving closer, you'd see the opposite. You see blue spectral lines. So from this we can understand that, yeah, we got the correct idea. We've got the correct theory. These red spectral lines, this is, you know, evidence that everything's moving away from each other. That's you know, the way to understand these lines. And therefore, this theory is correct. And hot diggity dog, you know. But Sataputta goes on to explain here that there's a defect in that thinking. He says, "What scientists do is first assume that earthly laws of physics apply without change throughout the universe. Then they try to figure out how processes obeying these laws could produce the observed light." In other words, they're seeing it, and they're just trying to figure out, okay, well, how do we... Here's these red lines. How do we understand them? Well, it's, you know, it's a Doppler. Doppler effect is something in physics. It's... let's see, in relation to pitch. Since so they have, it was founded by this guy Johann Doppler, and what he did was he put a bunch of musicians on a flat cart, and they were playing a trumpet, and as they moved away, these trained musicians could hear the pitch drop, and when they moved, and when he did the same experiment in reverse, they could hear the pitch go up. So they concluded from this that, okay, you know, the distance. As the sound waves compress, then you hear the pitch go up. And as the sound waves, as the thing's moving away, as the sound waves get further apart, you hear the thing. So they're interpreting this redshift, these light, this spectral signature, or whatever, as being a Doppler effect. And as everything's moving away from each other, and therefore you see the redshift. If everything was moving in towards each other, coming closer, you see a blue shift. But that's not the only explanation. You know, it's not like all the scientists aren't agreed on that. There's other scientists also, you know, astronomers, astrophysicists that say, oh, it could be another explanation. It could be just that the light is getting tired. You know, because as Sataputta mentions here, it says here, they assume that the laws of physics apply throughout the universe without change, but that might not be the case. So anyway, so other scientists, physicists are suggesting, no, it could be that as light travels, you know, through a powerful gravitational field, that's what causes it. In other words, what they're doing is they're presenting an interpretation of an observation. Nobody actually goes in, when they look at the telescope, look through the telescope, sees anything moving. Everything's static. Everything's staying in exactly the same place, you see. But they're interpreting those, what they see, those red lines, as being, this is a Doppler effect, everything's moving away. Okay, so that's one criticism of that theory. Another criticism of that theory is this. You know, they're saying it starts off as an explosion. right? There was this point of zero volume, and like I said, infinite temperature and density, and boom, and everything spread out and cooled down. And but according to Newton's second law of thermodynamics, that wouldn't make sense, because the second law of thermodynamics says that heat and natural processes in a system tend to go towards less useful energy and greater discord. See, in other words, as things... Yeah, if there's no intelligence behind the whole thing, it tends to break down, not develop into something more complex, sophisticated, and as it says here, useful. Yeah. Greater discord. You know, not more useful energy, but greater discord. So that's another criticism. And then a third criticism is when you get further down the line in that theory, it actually, as I mentioned, it talks about how, okay, first, you know, there's the plasma cools down and becomes normal gas, and the gas forms the galaxies form the stars, and the stars form the planets, and the planets, somehow some living forms come about, and the living forms, consciousness emerges at some point in the living forms, and then, you know, you live, and because the consciousness is actually an emergent property of matter, when the biological organization of the matter breaks down, that's the end of the consciousness, you see? But in mathematics, there's something called a counterexample. They use this to show the limits and boundaries of certain theorems. Okay, so in a counterexample, it works something like this. Say you have a premise that all students are lazy. Okay, that's the premise. All students are lazy. So if you can find one student that's not lazy, one diligent student, right, that's enough to demonstrate that that theorem or that idea is not universally applicable, you see? So it loses its validity as an axiomatic truth, as something that can be accepted, you know, absolutely. So in that sense, they're saying that consciousness develops at a mature stage of biochemical development, but if there could be one example given that that's not the case, then that becomes invalid as like being, you know, like presenting the absolute truth. Okay, so that evidence is there. Children remember their past lives. It's been studied by, studied by scientifically trained people for over 50 years now, and somebody could say, well, you know, this is, it's not something that's done under the control, laboratory controls. You know, this type of, it's, you know, careful investigation at best, and the evidence is anecdotal, it's not done in the laboratory control. Well, neither is this what they're doing. You know, this whole idea of the Big Bang, it's not laboratory controls. They're looking through a telescope, and they're interpreting something they see as meaning that everything's moving away from each other. Where's the laboratory controls there? So it's just as good a quality evidence. You know, if somebody is going to investigate it, the quality of evidence supporting that consciousness is irreducible and that it's not dependent upon matter, which is one of the main points Prabhupada's making here in this purport, that says without the basic principle of soul, the body cannot be produced. You know, so consciousness is not dependent upon matter. Matter of fact, it's the other way around. Matter is dependent upon consciousness. So, as I said, even it's material evidence, but... If the quality of the material evidence supporting this idea that consciousness is irreducible and it's not dependent upon matter, if it's as good as the quality of evidence that's saying that, okay, these lines, these spectral, red spectral lines can be interpreted like this, you get what's called cancellation. You see, you know, it's like somebody might say, well, you can't prove this is wrong because of that. But you can't. It's on a material level, but the quality of evidence is equally as good. So, you know, it kind of invalidates the theory once again as being a candidate for absolute truth. So, and Prabhupada also talks in this purport about the gyanis, basically. So the gyanis, you know, they're a little bit more advanced than the asuras or the gross materialists that think that, as Prabhupada says here, that matter is everything. You know, they're of the understanding that there's a spiritual basis for to matter. But they don't correctly understand. This is what Prabhupada's kind of alluding to here. But they don't correctly understand that spiritual basis in his proper perspective. You know, he talks about how in this purport he says, not knowing the conclusions of the Vedas, some people accept the material nature of substance, and others accept the spirit soul of substance, but actually Brahman is the substance, Brahman is the cause. So he's talking about Brahman here. And so there's, and he goes here, there's no validity to the expression Brahma Satyam Jagamitcha, this world is not false. So in those, there's a body of transcendentalists who reject the idea that matter is the basis of everything, much to their credit. They think that spirit is the basis of everything. But their contention is that when you're free from the illusion of matter, you know, the thinking the material body is the self, and when you actually become enlightened, then you'll understand that God and the living entity are one. You know, in all respects, is that's their idea, and we can go with that up to a point. We can go with that God and the living entity are one, but not in all respects. See? In other words, there are Vaishnav philosophies. There are five Vaishnav commentaries on the Vedanta Sutra, and of those, three of them actually refer to monism. One is called Shuddhadvaita, which is purified monism. These are Vaishnav commentaries on the Vedanta Sutra. There's Vishishtadvaita, which is specific monism. And then there's Dvaitadvaita, which is monism and dualism. The other two are Shuddhadvaita and Achinchabeta. But so there's, of those five, three Vaishnav commentaries on the Vedanta Sutra refer to monism, but they don't indulge in that idea that God and the living entity are one in all respects. That is the particular, the specific characteristic of what's called Kevaladvaita, exclusive monism, which is propounded by the Mayavadis. And this is what Prabhupada's objecting to. You know, Prabhupada's objecting to this understanding of monism, that the God and the living entity are one in all respects. That Mayavadis basically, and they believe that Krishna's body is material, and therefore devotional service to Krishna is material. God, as I mentioned, God and the living entity are one in all respects. And instead of worshiping the Supreme Personality of Godhead, they present themselves as God, and they want to be worshipped as God. So that's what Prabhupada is, objecting to. That's bogus. They come up with the example of, it's a nice example. You know, it's a nice analogy, but once again, before I even give the analogy, I'll make the point. Prabhupada said an analogy is good according to how many points of similarity there are. Okay, so this is the analogy they give. Imagine the Micronesian islands, but we'll expand it. But Pacific islands, you know, there's over 20,000. There's 20,000 to 30,000 islands in the South Pacific. Okay, so just try to visualize it. You know, you got Micronesia, Polynesia, Melanesia. You know, they're all down there, like kind of northeast of Australia and southwest of Hawaii. There's a whole 20 to 30,000 islands, right? Okay, so when you look at them, they look like they're all completely separate. If you're just flying over in an airplane, you say you're flying from Hawaii down to Sydney, Australia, you're going to see, wow, look at all these islands, man. Isn't that far out? But what if you drained the Pacific Ocean? What would you see? If you drained the Pacific Ocean, you wouldn't see like a bunch of little islands floating. You'd see that as you drain the ocean, you'd see that there's land connecting to those. It'd be like fingers. You see, like here, right now, imagine all you're seeing is the four tops of fingers, right? And it might look like, oh well, that's just four separate stubs up there, but they're not four separate stubs. They're four fingers. They're connected to the hand. So in the same way, when you drain the Pacific Ocean, you got all those islands, and they're connected to the Earth. You see, so that's the Mayavadi. That's the monist idea. They're saying we're all connected. We're all part of the same body. You know, it's just an illusion. If you take away just like you take away the water, and you can see it's all part of the same Earth. You take away the material body, the illusion, and you can see we're all part of that same oneness. You see? Now, it's pretty kind of catchy analogy, right? Right. I mean, almost can you can almost kind of like think, yeah, that sounds about right. That sounds good. It's attractive. But the personified Vedas have a and this is that's the analogy they would give you to support this idea that God and the living entity are one in all respects. You just remove the water, so to speak, or the illusion, and then you see, hey, we're all connected. We're all part of God. We're basically all God. All right. So, but what is our response to that? What is the Vaishnava response to that? Well, the Vaishnava response to that is given very expertly by the personified Vedas. And actually, ironically enough, Prabhupada in this purport refers to Bhagavad Gita, chapter 7, text 4 and 5. And in that same, in text 5 of chapter 7, Prabhupada quotes that verse that I'll read it to you. And this is our response to that point that God and the living entity are one in all respects. So this is Srimad Bhagavatam, chapter 87, text 30. Aparimita dhruvas tanu brito yadi sarvakatas tarhi na sas yetati niyamo dhruva nitarata ajani chayan mayantad avimucha nirantir bhavet samam anu janatam yad amatam mata dustataya. O Supreme Eternal, if the embodied living entities were eternal and all-pervading like you, in other words, if they were one with you in all respects, then they would not be under your control. But if the living entities are accepted as minute energies of your lordship, then they are at once subject to your supreme control. Therefore, real liberation entails surrender by the living entities to your control, and that surrender will make them happy. In that constitutional position only can they be controllers. Therefore, men with limited knowledge who advocate the monistic theory that God and the living entities are equal in all respects are actually guided by a faulty and polluted opinion. So that's the decision of the personified Vedas. That, you know, it's an incorrect way to understand. It's like, I mean, Giriraj Maharaj tells that story when I think it was one of the first times he met Prabhupada. You know, he said, I can't remember exactly what Prabhupada, do you want to worship God or do you want to be God? And Giriraj was silent. And then, but Prabhupada said something that Giriraj Maharaj remembered and he repeats. He said, how can God become non-God? It's like it says here. If the living entities were eternal and all-pervading like you, if living entities were equal to God in all respects, how do they come under the control of the illusory energy? Doesn't make any sense. That's what Prabhupada said on that occasion. How does God become non-God? And how does non-God become God? Doesn't make any sense. So that's personified Vedas have kind of hit the nail right on the head here, I think. And that's the conclusion. So basically, as pointed out here in the second part, they said, therefore, real liberation entails surrender of living entities to your control, and that surrender will make them happy. And that constitutional position only can they be controllers. And on that point, so basically, real liberation means just properly using our free will in Krishna's service. And I found an interesting little excerpt, I think it was from a conversation where Prabhupada elaborates upon that point. He says, so if you are a part and parcel of the whole, you have to take decisions from the whole. You cannot make the decisions. The finger does not make decisions for the entire body. The only decision you have to make is the decision to serve Krishna. The orders come from Krishna. Krishna ordered Arjuna to fight, and at the end of the Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna decided to abide by Krishna's will. This is the only choice we have, either to abide by Krishna's will or to defy his will. After we decide to obey Krishna, Krishna or his representative makes all the other decisions. So that's it. You see, we're not God. We're just, the energies. And our perfection lies in just trying to align our will with the will of Krishna or the will of God. And, it makes perfect sense. Then it makes perfect sense how it is that we're here in this material realm of illusion. We misused our free will. That's how we got here. We properly used our free will, and we can get out. And but one last point here, and then I'll end, is that it can be tricky. It can be tricky. And this is why Prabhupada makes this point here. He says, after we decide to obey Krishna, Krishna or his representative makes all other decisions. You know, it's not so easy thing to properly use your free will. You may agree in principle. You may think, yeah, I'm willing to properly use my free will. I want to, you know, align my will with the will of Krishna or abide by Krishna's will. But you need expert guidance to do that. And the example of that is, one example of that is Maharaj Yudhisthira. Maharaj Yudhisthira was a super advanced devotee, but he got it wrong. I'll read you this. Prabhupada says here, an interesting little section. It goes, if it is sanctioned by Krishna, then it is morality. Otherwise, the same morality may be immorality. Just like Yudhisthira was asked by Krishna to speak lie. Go to Dronacharya and inform him that your son is dead. Because Dronacharya had a benediction that unless he was shocked by the dead limbs of his son, he would not die. So he had to be shocked. But he would not believe anybody except King Yudhisthira because he was known as a very honest, he was known as very honest and truthful. Therefore, Krishna employed this service that you go. Maharaj Yudhisthira, he said, oh, how can I tell a lie? So Papa goes, so this is immorality. Krishna is ordering, and he is saying that, how can I say a lie? This is immorality. He is disobeying the order of Krishna. But Arjuna, on the other hand, he rejected all morality and immorality. He accepted Krishna's order. That is morality. He was personally thinking that if I kill my brothers, cousins, this, that, so many things. But because he was a pure devotee of Krishna, when he understood Krishna wants it, he said, yes. This is morality. That is the fact. When your actions are approved by the supreme authority, that is morality. If it is not approved by the supreme authority, that is immorality. Therefore, so-called morality, immorality, has no fixed position. When it is approved by Krishna, it is morality. Even so-called immorality will be morality, because he was killing. So that's so-called immorality, but it was because he was doing on Krishna's orders morality. And so-called morality, not telling a lie, was immorality in the case of Maharaj Yudhisthira. That we practically see. The same example as I gave you, that the soldier is killing so many human beings, he's awarded. And if he does what he likes when he after the war, then it becomes chaos. So the point I'm trying to make here, which is the final point, that's we really need that expert guidance. You need the direction of the bona fide spiritual master, because sometimes it's not so easy to work out what's doing Krishna's will and what's not doing Krishna's will. That we understand through the instructions of the spiritual master. And once again here, even Maharaj Yudhisthira, as an advanced devotee as he was, he got it wrong. You got it wrong, and that's a classic example. So we want to be very careful. You know, we want to abide by the will of Krishna, align our lives with the will of Krishna, and the way to do that is to just try to very meticulously follow the instructions of the bona fide spiritual master. So I'll stop there. Does anybody have any questions about any of these points? Yeah, Prabhu. Okay.
The expanding, the quote-unquote expanding universe, is accelerating.
Is what?
Is accelerating. So the rate of expansion is accelerating.
Okay.
Now, if you imagine that there is an explosion, right, the central point of gravity stays there, right? So the point of Big Bang is the center point of gravity. And the objects moving away from that point are attracted back to the point of gravity. So the rate of acceleration should decrease until the point that
decrease,
it stops.
Decrease.
It should decrease,
yeah,
until the point that it stops and comes back. That was a traditional view. But they say that not only it's not decreasing, but it's increasing the rate of expansion. So the way that they justify it, they didn't change the Big Bang theory. They said that there is such a thing as dark energy that is uniformly distributed in the universe. We don't know what it is. We haven't observed it, and we cannot observe it. And this uniform energy, which comprises, interestingly, 70% of the mass energy balance of the universe, is pulling out these like galaxies. That's why it's expanding. So they don't change the original theory, but they add another unknown that we don't have any way to observe it. You know, it's like it's unobservable, you know, in theory even. That's pulling it out. If you're wondering what is that other 30% of the mass and energy balance of the universe, it's not matter as we know it. It's like 5%, less than 5% of that mass is the observable mass, including the black holes. 20-something percent of it is another, like, it's called dark matter, that they needed for another justification of the formation of the theory of the galaxies.
So I think, like, you know, bottom line is
the original one. They just add unknowns.
Yeah, we're not astrophysicists, but it's any layman can understand. It sounds like there's a lot of speculating going on. You know, they're just speculating. They're interpreting different things and speculating. And so, you know, why should we take that super seriously? We don't have to. Anybody else? Any Dr. Eric or Akashma?
Hare Krishna, thank you. I was just curious, because I've heard before, when the universes are coming out from Karna, Dakshaya, Vishnu, you know, they emanate from the pores in his body, and I've heard at least some places it's described that they begin to expand, and then, you know, as they go farther and farther away from Vishnu, then they continue to expand, and then at the end of the manifestation, then they begin to contract as they return, and then, you know, or until they're reabsorbed into the body of Vishnu. So I was just curious, like how is that contradictory to like the observation of an expanding universe? I mean,
so okay. Right off the top of my head, I can't think of an answer. Judah Karma, you want to help me out on that one?
I mean, it does say that when the universes come out, the Mahavishnu glances at them and they expand. So there's some parallels there.
So possible there is some parallel. So
the universes come out in seed form, and then they expand to different sizes because, yeah, we're in the smallest universe. Our Brahma has four heads, but there are other universes that are much bigger where the Brahmas have 1,000 heads, 10,000 heads, 10 million heads.
So does that mean that these guys could be right? Is what, you know, is what Akashma is saying mean that they could be right? That, you know, that they have interpreted correctly and the universe is expanding? Or what's...
Well, the thing is there, where is it coming from? They would say from nothing. We would say from Mahavishnu, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. They would say it's all happening by chance. We would say it's happening by design.
Okay, so even if they got the expanding part right, they didn't get a lot of other things right.
And it's not clear from the Vedic point of view if it's still expanding.
Okay, three good points there. You know, they got it wrong about that. They say it's expanding from nothing. We say it's expanding from Mahavishnu. What was the second point?
It's just accidental.
It's accidental, and we say it's not accidental.
It's happening by chance.
It's not happening by chance.
It's by design.
It's by design, and they're saying it's still happening, and we don't know. We don't necessarily agree with that it's still expanding at this point. Okay, somebody else? Mother Karuna Dharani? These are good things to know. When you're out on book distribution, you might have somebody bring these things up, and it'll be good to know them, yeah.
It was a very, very nice class. I can tell you've been at the observatory a lot because you're considering all that. I wanted to say that when Prabhupada would give an analogy about Mayavadi, that Mayavadis give, he would often refute it and give it in terms of Vaishnav Siddhanta, like the birds in the green tree. Mm-hmm. You know, and then he would say, well, actually, no, all those green birds are individual birds. And then he would say the fish going down the river to the ocean, but no, those fish retain their individuality. You know, so then I was thinking about the islands you mentioned in the water. Well, the water would, for one thing, the water would never dry up. So all those islands still maintain their individuality, and some of them are volcanoes, and they don't want to stay in this material world. They want to explode and leave this world. The soul wants to leave and go back to Godhead. So we never see that all the islands are the same. They're all different. There could be Alcatraz. There could be Hawaii. You know, there's different kinds of islands. So some islands, it's not that they're all just part of the matter, and we're all just matter, and that we all just merge, and they're all connected underneath. But actually, they're all individuals, and they all have individual potential to act independently for Krishna's service.
Yeah, thank
you. Be liberated.
That's the idea.
Anyway, that's my attempt to say that analogy in terms of Vaishnava Krishna consciousness.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Neela Madhava, and then that'll be it.
I just want to say that, examining at the source of the motivation of the scientists versus, let's say, the sadhu, is that these scientists are totally entangled and bought into this material system. If they say the wrong thing, they will be replaced or fired. You know, whereas a sadhu has given up all stake in this world and simply to engage in unalloyed service to Krishna, doesn't have any motivation behind influencing what he's going to say to you. He's going to tell you what the truth is. Mm-hmm. So just like somebody who's drunk can't possibly drive correctly, somebody who is entangled in the modes of material nature and are on the mental platform, they can never produce the accurate truth. And so that's one way to see it. That's what my feeling is.
Thank you. Guntra Chima Bhagavatam Ki Jai, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Yeah.